Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Brett Jenks. He is the CEO of Rare, and he joins us today as he's visiting Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So Rare is a conservation organization based in Washington, D.C. that I'd never heard of, but it does some incredible work. What's it all about?
Well, thanks. A lot of people haven't heard of us. We'd like to think we're changing that. Motley Fool called us the best charity you've never heard of, which is okay for a while, I guess. Essentially what Rare does is work around the world to help local conservation leaders become change agents, to change the behavior of the citizens of some of the most pristine and wild areas around the world, to change their behaviors in order to protect these sites. Whether you're talking about rainforests in Central America and South America, fisheries in Indonesia, Rare is working to train local leaders who can help mobilize society to live more sustainably.
Now, this was a part of the idea for Rare came about when a biologist got his training, decided to go to a place where there was an endangered parrot, and realized that nobody wanted to talk or listen to science speak, and he really had to change his way of communicating in order to save this parrot.
Yeah, this is an iconic story for conservation and for Rare. A guy named Paul Butler was a youngster, just graduated from London Polytechnic, and went down to St. Lucia as a young British biologist. And in St. Lucia found that their national bird was on the verge of extinction. In fact, the IUCN, a global network of conservation groups, had said publicly that this bird would not survive till the year 2000. This was in the mid-1980s. And so, much like the rest of the conservation world, a young biologist had to become a change agent in order to save a species. What Paul did was look around at the way that commercial marketing practices influence behaviors.
When he realized that he wasn't getting anywhere being himself.
Well, he was talking about, you know, the Forestry Department of St. Lucia would roll up in their Jeep to a rural community, and they'd come out and they'd start talking about watersheds and ecosystem services. This is where your water comes from, and you need to know that without the forest or without the forest, you're not going to have a clean water supply. And people would sort of roll their eyes because it wasn't yet tangible. Then they would talk about the parrot, the fact that you're losing the parrot. People would say, no, we love the parrot. That's why we put them in cages, and people put them in hotel lobbies. And that's why people come from other countries to buy them and take them home. And from those kinds of threats, this parrot was getting wiped out. Well, they were down to 100 in the wild. And so Paul started, he scratched his head and said, so what changes people's attitudes and behaviors? And he looked at TV commercials, and he looked at marketing, and he thought, well, you know, if you can take whale blubber and turn it into perfume, and people think it makes them sexy, or if you can sell a pack of cigarettes when it says on the label that it will kill you, there's something here that conservationists need to learn from. And so he set out to launch a campaign, basically a campaign to save the parrot. And he didn't villainize anybody. He didn't blame the St. Lucian people. But he said, this is a symbol of our pride. This is an endemic bird. It's found nowhere else on Earth. And as a symbol of our nation, as important as our flag or our cricket team or what have you, we need to protect it. And through billboards, posters, bumper stickers, corporate alliances, public festivals and parades, he made everybody aware of the plight of their endangered national bird. Over the course of about...
So what did that... I mean, a little more specifically, what did that look like? Yeah.
I'll put it this way. It got to the point that a couple of poachers were caught with St. Lucian parrots up in a forest. And the forestry department captured them, caught them, arrested them, called the prime minister... And the prime minister came out. This is after a year of campaigning.
So the
level of awareness and public scorn for parrot poachers had risen to the point that there was a cavalcade back through the capital city with these parrots that they then took out to the forest and released in the wild again. So from you know, the way we think about, the way RARE thinks about measuring success is how, what is the commitment of people to conservation? So how many people first know about a parrot or a habitat or how important a particular watershed or a reef is? How many people understand the problems and the threats? Then what's the public attitude towards protecting it? Eventually, then, we want to measure success in terms of the health of an ecosystem or the number of parrots. In this case today, 20 years later, there's over 700 parrots in the wild in St. Lucia. The species has been saved, and it's the St. Lucian people who did it. What happened was, as a result of this what became public outcry, they changed legislation that created a mandatory jail sentence and a big fine for anyone caught with a parrot, so all the poaching stopped. They created a national park to provide habitat for this bird. You know, some people may roll their eyes and say, okay, well, why is a St. Lucian parrot so important? You know, morally, it's one species. It's the only one of its kind in the entire world. So if you're not St. Lucian, at least you can take interest in protecting a one of a kind. I mean, this could be the Hope Diamond. It just happens to have feathers and fly around the forest. From another standpoint, protecting that forest also protects the source of clean, potable water for St. Lucia and provides habitat that is now regularly visited by tourists. So it boosts the economy, protects the water supply, and is a symbol of pride. People go to St. Lucia to see the St. Lucian parrot, and the average St. Lucian, you know, just fly into the airport there, walk through customs and ask someone, and they'll tell you. What's really interesting, though, is 20 years later, they'll also tell you the theme song of the campaign that many people can still sing this many years later.
And that's the thing. I mean, using the methods of advertising instead of trying to sell you cheap plastic things that you don't need, they're actually trying to do something worthwhile, but using the exact same techniques that they used to sell sugar and you know, anything else.
Exactly. Well, you know, what we've realized is commercial marketing is effective because people want to identify themselves with something. Everyone is looking to figure out who they are, what they stand for, what their values are. And unfortunately, often, we make those decisions based on our purchases. So you know, why do they show men's deodorant ads and truck advertisements during the Super Bowl? Because if you're watching you're more likely, if you're watching the Super Bowl, to be the kind of person who's interested in defining yourself through the purchase of a truck. I'm a big fan of football. I'm not passing judgment on anybody. But clearly that's what the advertisers think, because they're trying to help people associate themselves and this manly sport with trucks. The same thing takes place in any different product, in any commercial arena. But it also takes place in society. The friends you choose, the candidates that you choose to support, people are constantly defining themselves. And so RARE has become sort of the conservation organization focused on helping people identify with their place so that they can play a role in protecting it.
Now, you have sites all over the world. Tell us about some of the other places where you're working and how the different campaigns have gone. I would think, for example, you know, to save a parrot, which is already a symbol of St. Lucia and is a beautiful bird and has beautiful feathers, which is why they were trying to export them in the first place. Okay, you can sell a parrot. It's harder to sell plankton or things, you know, some ugly little fish or whatever.
Well, if you ask the plankton specialist, they'd probably disagree with you. But you're right. It's a little more complex to sell a concept like a watershed. Now, where does your water come from? How many people actually know where their water comes from? With climate change and with population growth, increasingly people are concerned about water. Just read any newspaper, read the cover stories over the course of a couple of weeks, and you'll start hearing about global crises that are born of water shortages. What we try to do then, if we're going to launch a 12 different projects over the next couple of years in the Andes in South America. And in each of these cases, these highland communities in the Andes, we're talking about Venezuela, Ecuador, Colombia, there are remote communities whose forests provide water not only for them, but for many millions of people downstream. And so we're not going to create a symbol of a watershed and celebrate the watershed. We're going to find in the process some endemic, unique, found nowhere else on Earth, birds, amphibians, reptiles. You know, there's some sexy flora and fauna in the Andes, as you might guess. And we will help those become symbols that become the ambassadors, the mascots, the spokesmen for the environment. In the process, though, also talking to people about the fact that their legislation is changing all over the world, and those rural communities can be compensated for protecting the water supply by municipalities downstream. You know, that Quito, the largest city in Ecuador, for example, is creating new structures whereby they're compensating rural farmers who don't cut down the trees and receive compensation, not only to reduce climate change, but also to ensure water supply. So it's a combination of financial incentives and pride, pride in place.
Well, let's talk about the economic incentives. I mean, there are numbers of cases where there is, for example, slash and burn agriculture, or agriculture which produces erosion, or other ways of fishing that are violent to the coral reefs, or whatever. And that's the way it's done. It's probably not the way it was done 500 years ago, so it's not like you're trying to destroy a long-standing indigenous tradition, but nevertheless, that's the way it's done now. That's the way people eat and do their economy. How do you compensate for economic loss, or is there necessarily economic loss when people change their habits to be more environmentally friendly?
It depends on the case. It depends on the place. Clearly, at times, financial sacrifice is part of the process. So the question is, how do you compensate people in the short term? We're working increasingly with fisheries communities in the developing tropics. So we're talking about countries like Indonesia and Malaysia. We're talking about Mexico, the Gulf of California, where what's needed because of population growth and because of overfishing by local fishermen in many cases are no-take zones. Essentially the same way that farmers for centuries have left fields fallow, we need a global movement to create no-take zones so that fisheries everywhere have reproductive zones that can ensure that the fishermen aren't just fishing for today, but that their grandchildren will also be fishing for a lifetime. That's a big challenge. So there's a guy right now studying in our program, one of the rare fellows from Madagascar. His name is Gildas. And he gave a great talk the other night at Georgetown University, where he's studying in the RARE's Global Master's Program for Communications and Conservation, something we've just launched this year to train local leaders all over the world. So Gildas has come all the way from Madagascar to Georgetown to study the methods of social change, social marketing, conservation planning that will let him go back to Madagascar and mobilize the youth. 50% of his population is under 15, the coastal youth, so that they understand they're going to have to set up a better managed fishery if they're going to fish through their adulthood, much less if their children are going to fish over time.
I was reading in a book not long ago that 90% of the fish that were in the sea in 1950 are gone. We only have 10% of the world fish supply that we had a little over 50 years ago. I mean, that's huge. It's not only maintaining populations, but I would think increasing them is part of the problem, you know, part of the necessity.
The fisheries are under a global onslaught. There are few fisheries around the world that are not currently being overfished or on the verge of crisis. And this is simply a result of it being so difficult for us to have the data to show the actual decline. Data is not just the only reason. There's also sort of the culture of fishing is one in which you don't plant, you don't fertilize, you don't tend the soil, you don't even own the land in which you're fishing. So rights-based management is virtually impossible. So there's a tragedy of the commons. Everybody takes, who gives back?
Right.
Well, so what we're trying to do in a number of sites in Indonesia, in the Gulf of California, now in Madagascar, is help local conservation leaders who know and often who are working with communities that recognize the decline of their fishery to mobilize not only political leaders, local leaders, but the fishermen and their families to set up management systems. To basically say, look, we need to take this into our own hands. governments are decentralizing authority to local communities, which is a common trend around the world. So these fisheries over time will be able to manage themselves, but they've got to get it right because there isn't much time. And the goal would be set up a community no-take zone. Ideally, though, that the scientists tell us, we need to get to the point of one-third of the entire fishery being set aside. So to your point about economic sacrifice, in the short term, not fishing on 30% of an entire area can be a sacrifice. So we need to work on the kinds of incentives that we can bring to these communities.
What kind of incentives can you bring?
Well, one of them is rights. You right now they have no rights in many cases over their own fishery. They don't have the right to defend their fishery. So even if they take good care of it, the tragedy of the commons will result in people coming from other areas to fish.
Right.
I was talking to someone the other day who's saying, you know, even if we certify, think about live reef fish globally, the fish that end up in an aquarium.
Because they are so beautiful.
They're
and
so
they really
beautiful.
Are.
It's the same as the parrot phenomenon, only it's much harder to gauge. And once you create these no-take zones and once you start protecting reefs systematically, well, you're almost creating the pen into which an illegal fisherman can just show up and harvest. So how do you empower people by giving them almost the equivalent of land rights? So many of the major conservation organizations in RARE are working on land rights, the equivalent, rights-based management for fisheries. So one of the things I just got noticed today that we've been working with a number of government agencies and local NGOs in the Gulf of California in Mexico, and as of just the last couple of days, the government fisheries administration, CONAPESCA, is interested in striking a deal with a number of communities whereby even in national parks, marine parks, they will offer communities a concession to manage species take, to manage essentially the ocean, the sea. In exchange, they'll need to manage it. They'll need to provide the data that shows that the fisheries are increasing and stabilizing. They'll need to ensure that the no-take zones are in place. But all of this comes down, in the end, it comes down to communication. How do we change people's behaviors? How do we change people's attitudes? And we've learned a lot from commercial marketing, as I said, but in the end, it always comes down to sort of a deal. The same deal you make with the provider of a product when you buy the product. And it is, how will this make me feel? Is it a good deal? Is this product going to last? Do my friends think that this is a good idea? And so we're systematically charting a course for change. We call it a theory of change, which sort of sounds a little too esoteric. But in each one of the hundreds of campaigns that we're running now and will be running over the next several years around the world, there is a theory for social change that these young conservation leaders are designing themselves and implementing and that we're tracking. So you'll be able to anybody who's listening over the next couple of years can pick a favorite spot where there's a RARE Pride campaign, go on to either our website, rareconservation.org, or rareplanet.org, and you'll be able to track systematically the experience of a guy like Paul Butler working in St. Lucia, of a young man like Jill Das in Madagascar, who's saying, we had a meeting with the municipality today, and this municipality is interested and ready to launch the no-take zone. The mothers held a bake-off yesterday, and 1,000 people came out for the parade, and now they're ready to take on this new strategy. The goal is to get this palpable sense of local movements all over the world by people who are aware of what's at stake and who are committed to protecting their backyards, not only for their benefit, but for the rest of the planet.
We're talking to Brett Jenks. He is the CEO of RARE. The one very important factor is that you do try to get to young people, and there have been examples where there was an attempt to teach people about conservation that really didn't fly with the adults, but then they had somebody dress up in a fabulous costume and talk about it in the schools, and that went home to the parents, and then the movement took root.
Well, you know, it's funny. People have criticized environmental educators for a long time, those who believe that it's as simple as going into schools, telling their children, the children go home, they talk to their parents, And for the most part, if that's your only strategy, I would agree. It can help, but children don't vote, so that change doesn't happen right away. Generational shifts, there's so many influences on children over time, it's not really that direct. But clearly there are roles that advertising to children, marketing to children, can play in these kinds of social change efforts. I think you saw this in the recent campaign. But in specific cases, we have seen, one case I remember recently was in the Yucatan Peninsula. A child went home from a campaign activity run by a local conservation group called Niños y Crías, this great little group on the north coast of the Yucatan in Mexico. The campaign mascot is this big, glorious pink flamingo, and it's sort of like the mascot for your local football team or your basketball team. Only they have this cavalcade and parade and folkloric ballet. They have their own theme song. They get introduced like celebrities in very rural villages. Well, the theme of the year was recycling. So many plastic bottles are now dumped into these estuaries that they're affecting the flamingo populations, and they become vectors for disease because literally the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes breed in these plastic bottles that float around. And that increases, you know, common diseases in the tropics, whether it's malaria or others. And in this particular case, a child came home and talked to her parents about recycling. Well, one of the parents went back to work the next day and began to talk to a company that works with the local oil company, Pemex, which is a Mexican-owned oil conglomerate, and they created a program just in the north coast of the Yucatan to begin recycling both the oil containers that fishermen often use and discard. So they created a program where people could return them, and a recycling program for plastic bottles. Well, they've now recycled over 1 million plastic bottles. They're actually recycling them and then selling them to companies like Patagonia, who turn them into faux chinchilla jackets that you look around, many people are wearing these days. So children...
Faux chinchilla jackets out of Yucatan plastic bottles.
Real story.
Amazing.
And so that's the power of change and the power of influence. But it's not as simple as we're not naive enough to think that just marketing to children is going to do this. You have to be marketing to the politicians. You have to be marketing to the civic leaders. But the fact is, each of these campaigns specifically targets religious leaders. You know, there are Muslim clerics in Indonesia speaking out about conservation systematically in every campaign we run. In Latin America, there are Catholic priests or fundamentalists who are on Sundays speaking out to their congregations about the value of water or coral reefs or endangered species. Without all those constituencies pushing for conservation, you know, you can't compete with Coca-Cola and Chevron and, you know, the big brands. And environment, the whole environment needs a big PR campaign, let's face it.
And when you think about places like Mexico and, you know, Latin countries, Indonesia, there are a lot of places that, unlike us, are not yet completely addicted to cell phones and television, and where the way they communicate with each other is in person. So if their priest or whatever religious leader is talking to them, they're actually hearing it.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. There was a great local conservationist in Mexico that we've worked with for a decade named Salvador Garcia. And I love telling Salvador's story because he came to us in 2000 after a couple of bad years of forest fires. And he said, look, Mexicans are as proud as anybody. And these pride campaigns that you guys have been running in the Caribbean, he had heard about Paul Butler's campaign in St. Lucia, I think could really work here, but I need help figuring out how to roll it out. And I've been an environmental educator for a decade. I think I can run this kind of campaign. Well, over 2 years, he mobilized, using this the sort of the rare pride cookbook, he mobilized priests, musical artists, performing artists, folkloric ballets, municipal presidents. He ended up galvanizing a community to change the behavior of farmers to reduce forest fires. They were never vilified. After a six-month campaign, the farmers started coming out to say, we know the fires are a problem. We didn't know they were wiping out the park. We didn't know they were affecting the water. But we have known seen the water dropping off lately. So what can we do? And it was pretty easy then to introduce a couple of pretty basic techniques to reduce forest fires. But by having these close-knit communities utilize their own forms of communication, the church, the canteen, I mean, literally a mariachi song went to top five on the charts in three states. So that imagine the experience of the average farmer. At home, he's hearing it from his children, maybe his wife. At the cantina, he hears some mariachi guy singing about it. At church, he's hearing it from the priest. Walking down the sidewalk, he's seeing a billboard, and there's posters in all the stores. It's constant communication, the same thing that you would see during a political campaign. In fact, that was the first time in Guadalajara that somebody referred to a Rare Pride campaign as a Coca-Cola campaign, because they said the marketing of these campaigns was as ubiquitous as Coca-Cola. But to your cell phone comment, what is changing rapidly is the adoption of mobile phone technology. In many countries in which we work, they've bypassed all the underground lines to just go cellular. So everywhere we go around the world, you know, cell service is often better than it is here in the United States, because they've bypassed all the other systems to go straight to cellular. So we're working on a number of technologies right now that will let add to the marketing arsenal of these local change agents. We want them to be able to have these campaigns produce tweets using Twitter and other quick microblogging technologies, just like anyone else would here, to get out to all those constituents in their communities while they're getting their messages out. We're also looking at reporting, so that when there's illegal logging or illegal fishing on a reef, people can use their cell phones to report these illegal instances, which you know, is a sign of not only awareness and attitude, but actual behavior change.
We're talking to Brett Jenks, the CEO of Rare. You obviously have to be cultivating, finding, and hooking up with local leaders, local organizations, local non-government organizations in the places where there are environmental problems. How do you do that?
With great care. There are some very, very talented local conservation leaders around the world. And one of the challenges that they face is often they're isolated. They don't have enough funding. It's hard for them to... It's hard for them to pick up on what's working elsewhere. So there's a lot of reinventing of the wheel. Our approach is to try to bring a proven process and a proven program, but let them customize it and adapt it to their local socioeconomic or political or cultural conditions. Generally, what we do is build awareness within the conservation arena of our approach and our programs, and then ask them to demonstrate their interest. We don't want to sort of go hand-pick. We really feel that working with us requires such a commitment on the part of our local partners that we don't want to be selling the service to them. We really want them to say, hey, pick me. I think I could do this. I can commit 2 full years of my life to doing nothing more than galvanizing this community in pursuit of a tangible and globally significant environmental goal. And I'm ready to sign up. Otherwise, a lot of people would say yes if you're going to say, hey, look, in the process, you're going to get a master's degree, you know, the first global master's in communications for conservation. You're going to get some financing to put together this
You really
this
do
pride
get a master's
campaign.
Degree?
Yeah, it's really exciting. We just launched this. We decided what these guys do in a year. You know, I have an MBA from Georgetown University. The equivalent would be that my professors, you know, if I graduated from my MBA program and launched a startup, my professors would have to be on my board, and they would be compensated for the success of my business. That's the way RARE runs its program. So our staff are dedicated full-time completely to nothing other than training and supporting these local leaders, which is the kind of support that very few people get in their lifetime
right.
by anybody. So the Masters is really just an additional incentive and a carrot. But what's exciting about it is this global Masters, which is provided by University of Texas at El Paso, is taught at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. for English speakers from all over the world.
So all these people have to speak English. I would think that is a prerequisite.
No, and here's what's really great about this. So it's quite an innovation. We teach it in Mandarin at Southwest Forestry College in Yunnan Province, China. We teach it in Bahasa Indonesia at the Bogor Institute outside of Jakarta. We teach it in Spanish at the University of Guadalajara. So we're building this sort of global factory.
And in English at Georgetown.
In English at Georgetown. So we have this global factory for change agents. And over the course of two... So imagine this is your experience as a grad student. You're handpicked from a site that is critically important globally for species, for habitats, for ecosystem services, for coral reefs, for rainforests, something of global significance. You're picked to then travel to a university where you can study in your language. You study for 17 weeks over 2 years, but spend most of the time back home implementing all of these strategies. So you have 9 weeks of training. You have 4 months in the field planning, designing your campaign. You need to figure out what threat, what problem you're going to target. Who are your allies? Who's going to work with you to support this? Then you come back and you study guerrilla marketing tactics. So it's from pamphleting and billboards and bumper stickers to working with ad agencies on copy and PR people on press releases to how to mobilize a parade, how to work with political leaders, etc. Then they go home and they have a year uninterrupted, nonstop.
And they're financially supported.
And they're financially supported to implement the entire campaign. They don't graduate until they successfully roll out that entire campaign. And until they can show that they've measured pre-campaign and post-campaign increases in knowledge of, you know, statistically valid surveys of 1% of the population, knowledge, attitudes, and eventually behaviors. So what's so great about this program now is large conservation organizations and governments, like the government of Mexico, the government of Peru, the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, these organizations now come to us to say, we need your help training local conservation leaders in places in which we're working because we know what the problems are. We need help building the public support necessary for change.
Do the various leaders who you are training in all of these different areas, do they have a vehicle whereby they can learn from each other?
Yeah, and it's under development right now, and it's probably what I'm most excited about. And it's a little too clunky. It's open source. Basically, it's a social network. It's like Facebook for local change agents and conservation. And it's called rareplanet.org. Now, I don't want to send, I don't know how many people listen to this show, but I don't want to send too many to this site yet. But over the next few months, as we continue to work on it, basically we've built a platform in Mandarin, Bahasa, English, and Spanish, and you can literally toggle back and forth between those languages, where you can get, you'll see a homepage for each of these campaigns around the world. There's over 150 of them up right now. There's 65 active campaigns around the world. So there's 65 active Pride campaigns in 23 countries, and you can reach out and communicate with any of those campaign managers directly. What's exciting about it is they're forming their own groups to talk about legislation that would enable communities to be paid for protecting their forests. They're creating groups to talk about how do you work with municipal leaders? What really gets them fired up publicly? There might be a technical group on how do we improve the quality of our surveys, or we're getting data here we're not sure how to interpret. So it's technical, it's social, it's political. Basically, it's the network that lets them improve their practice, and they love it. You know, they're also saying happy birthday around the world to their friends and wishing each other luck on a big upcoming event. It's not quite as neat as Facebook, but it's not just happy birthday and, you know, what'd you do on your vacation. It's I'm saving one of the world's most important coral reefs. I need help. Who's the expert globally on this measure, or how we're going to quantify, over time, our results, or this particular strategy? So we're building it just for them to reduce their isolation. The world's getting to be smaller and smaller, but these conservationists locally need help from everybody everywhere else.
To what extent, if it does at all, does population control play into the educational campaigns?
RARE used to spend a lot of time working on population. We had radio soap operas, believe it or not, in the Caribbean and in the Pacific that were wildly successful. But we've decided that it was too hard for us to be a conservation organization one day and an economic development organization another day and a population group the next day. So we've streamlined the program. It is a factor. You know, look at Madagascar in the case of this young guy, Gilles Das, who gave a great presentation the other night and said, look, he showed this big image up on the wall that it was a cut screen, and half the screen was a school of thousands and thousands of fish. And the other half of the screen was hundreds and hundreds of young boys sitting in the town. And he said, look, we have a fishery, and we have 50% of our population under age 15. They all believe they're going to be fishermen for the rest of their lives. These two things are coming to a head. We've got to understand how we're all going to work together to manage our fishery. So population is one of the driving sources of all of our challenges. But I don't think population ultimately, as we see the global trends leveling off at 9 or 10 billion globally, if people can manage themselves, if we can evolve human behavior, if we can evolve our civilization, I don't think population has to wipe out the environment. It comes down to technology, it comes down to policy, and it comes down to our sense of responsibility. If we live lighter on the land, population shouldn't be the crisis that it could be.
We're talking to Brett Jenks. He's the CEO of RARE. So when you look at, I mean, we have the example of the parrot that really did, it was saved. 100 parrots went to 700 parrots in a period of years. Have you been able to evaluate the efficacy of the programs in other places?
Yeah, we look very intensively at a series of indicators in each of these campaigns that let us gauge performance. You know, it's not always easy to do. With parrots, for example, it's a lot easier than other things. You've got government agencies set up to go out and do a census of parrots. If you're talking about coral reefs, they're underwater, they're more expensive to monitor. The science is getting there, but sometimes it's beyond the bandwidth of a local conservation leader running a pride campaign. So we count on our partner organizations to do that. What we try to measure most often instead is a proxy indicator of success. So if you know that the threat, the loss of forests is coming from forest fires, then you can measure the incidence of forest fires. And so we've seen campaigns that have reduced forest fires by 45% in a year. Another campaign that reduced forest fires by 78% in 2 years, simply by changing the behavior of local farmers. You have to discount those numbers because sometimes it's an El Nino year and the forests are really dry, or when you do the initial surveys, they're wet when you do the final survey. But we're measuring success in those ways everywhere we work. We're about to launch this may get a little too technical for folks, but I think everyone would understand the idea of experimental design. We're going to do 12 campaigns in the next couple of years in the Andes, as I mentioned. What we want to do is actually track success at 24 so that we can compare the 12 campaigns that have been run by RARE's local partners and 12 sites that are very similar where there's been essentially nothing's been
nothing
done.
Nothing happens, right.
And over time, one of the world's largest donors, the Global Environment Facility, that's going to finance some of this work, their head of evaluation is really excited about this because he said, look, we've spent $4 billion on conservation efforts around the world. We've never done an experimental design like this. So we're really committed to trying to figure out how the extent of social change and the extent of our ability to actually manage and measure those kinds of results. But this is really the leading edge in the conservation field. It's not easy to do, there hasn't been a lot of pressure on environmentalists to measure and provide that kind of data, but I think that's changing, and I think conservationists are increasingly going to be looking to really demonstrate the efficacy of their programs to justify their approaches, and not just for funding, because there are limited resources. We need to make sure that everything we do is as effective as it can possibly be.
There is a kind of romantic idea which has some truth to it and some not truth to it, which is that indigenous people know what they're doing. There is indigenous knowledge which has to be respected, and then there are also things that work when you've got a small population that suddenly don't work when you have a large population. How do you sort all of that out? How do the leaders sort all of that out and respect the knowledge that's already there in a community?
Well, it's a really important issue. People who have inhabited any place for centuries have rights, I think inalienable rights, to have a say in how those places are managed. From a conservation standpoint, often indigenous communities have a wealth of information to offer. Someone has just, I don't know the name of this researcher, but I just heard recently about a paper that's been produced for the carbon market. Which we can talk briefly about in a few minutes if you'd like, they're trying to measure the avoided deforestation in rural communities and the impact that that has on greenhouse gases. So that, you know, if we all know that 20% of greenhouse gases around the world actually comes from deforestation, you cut down a tree, the tree ends up releasing all the carbon dioxide that it has sequestered over the years. And that creates greenhouse gases. Especially in countries like Brazil, in countries like Indonesia, this is an extremely important issue, as important as the energy use in your home or however you drive around town. What a researcher recently found is the carbon calculations by indigenous people in certain forests, once they understand just what that numerical factor is per tree or per area, their calculations have been as accurate as the carbon accountants themselves, which is phenomenal. Now, I imagine that's not true everywhere. But the point is, there's take fisheries, another great example. The fishers know where the fish are, quite often. And they know what areas need to be left fallow, so to speak, to regenerate. Those are the areas they're not fishing now because they're not catching anything. They often know that fisheries are in decline. Data does help, though. And science does help. You need science not just to help provide the graph that shows the declining fishery, but also to convince the donors, the government, the Minister of Finance. You really need both. So the question is, how do you create a partnership between local inhabitants and those who have additional powers over how those resources are going to be used? Often indigenous people don't have territorial rights. So it's not as simple as saying, Let's simply enable you to manage this land. We also need to make sure they have the legal right and authority so that someone else doesn't take that authority away later. But it's complex.
You gave that example earlier with the fisheries. How does a conservation organization in Washington, D.C. basically try to change political fisheries rights in Madagascar or any other coastal place?
Well, we're not a lobbying organization, even internationally. But we want to enable our partners to be very effective when they're trying to make change in their countries.
So basically, in addition to all these ecological marketing campaigns, that morphs into political campaigns.
Right. You take the analogy of all the folks who would help a John McCain or a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama develop their strategies for their campaigns and write their press releases and help coach them on how to communicate and how to position. We're providing to local conservation leaders who often are trained as biologists. You know, biology helps you name the problem. Biology is not a solution to what is a human behavior challenge. And so in the same way that a political advisor might be able to help, we want to help local conservationists prepare their talking points. We want them to do the research that says, so they can determine what radio station do people listen to. So make sure you get on those programs. Make sure you get on those shows. Make sure you understand where people get their information and who they trust and where their head is at now before your campaign starts, because you need to meet people where they are. You need to start with them.
Do you ever find examples where there are opposition forces to the campaign, the Rare Pride campaigns?
We're very careful about that. We tend to pick the low-hanging fruit. So if there's a big crisis, you know, a big encounter between indigenous groups and an oil pipeline, for example, there are other conservation organizations that are better equipped to take on those sort of real hot issues. We tend to want to work where there's clearly an advantage for people to protect what's theirs, where a positive campaigning approach is going to be effective. Maybe it's because we don't have the stomach for it, maybe because there are other groups that can do it, but we tend to avoid the hot potatoes. We're just looking for the quickest way to enable local success.
We're talking to Brett Jenks. He's the CEO of Rare. Now, you are one of many groups in the field of conservation. How has the field of conservation evolved? This is one example, and you actually are hired by other conservation groups to do these types of projects. Has the conservation field become more savvy in general to the need to really speak to people where they are?
I think so. I think it's really changing significantly, especially as conservationists watch other things taking place around them in society. I mean, for years, you go back 100 years when the United States was initially creating protected areas. You know, John Muir and his compatriots, the photographers, the painters, the Bierstadts, the Ansel Adams, these guys were running very romantic campaigns about saving nature, making sure that people in cities would have a place to drive to, or an idyllic vision of wildness as the country developed. And so romanticism has always been a part of the conservation movement to some degree. I think over the last 20 years, big conservation organizations and scientists have worked hand in hand to really specialize in naming the places, you know, the ecological systems that we need to protect. So the focus on coral reefs, because that's where our fish come from, and mangroves, because that's where our fish come from. Forests, because our climate stability relies on forests, and because our lumber supply and our water supply depends upon them. They're the Earth's lungs. We've as a conservation community over the last 25 years, we've gotten really good at identifying what needs to be saved. So every conservation group worth its salt has a big map of its most important places, and they're all labeled differently to help promote and celebrate, as they should, the efforts of those organizations to save those places or to save those species. I think what's the challenge the last 10 years has been digging deeper to name the actual threats to those places. And as soon as you start naming the real threats to the environment, you realize the threats aren't biological. The threats are social, they're political, they're economic, they're cultural. And so the toolkit that got you there, the biologically based toolkit that helped you assess the habitat or count the species, isn't the solutions-oriented toolbox. So there's a lot of R&D going on around the world now about how to change attitudes and behaviors. There's a lot of work going on about how are we going to become more politically savvy. So many conservation organizations are what I call moving upstream. They're moving up to really begin to lobby governments more effectively, both on the Hill here in the United States, whether you're talking about cap and trade or increasing foreign investment in conservation of forests and of reefs, so that America can play a leading role in that front, or even in the countries in which these big international organizations have offices and subsidiaries or chapters, they're becoming more politically savvy. So they're working with corporations and they're working with policymakers. RARE is really helping foment that change, I think, by providing a litany of examples around the world where, you know, training a local conservation leader from a small conservation organization and equipping them with the tools to mobilize society, they're showing demonstrable effects. And I know that's working because and helping influence behaviors, because now we're being asked to start national campaigns. You know what? If we can create a protected area or build public support for it in the Andes of let's say Peru.
Can you do it in Colorado?
Well, that comes up as well. So we get asked all the time, so when are you going to start doing you know, national campaigns in the U.S. And people have been saying that to us for 5 or 6 years. Why don't you do something about climate change and people's behavior in the United States? And the fact is, there are millions of dollars being spent right now on addressing Americans' behavior. Every corporation is talking about it. Every magazine is talking about it. Every mainstream to media outlet is talking about it. Literally millions and millions of dollars, and it's starting to have an impact. I mean, these discussions that people would not have had 5 years ago are commonplace, and that's how you track the potential for social change. How often does someone talk to you about footprint or a car purchase or greenhouse gases or something related to the climate? I'd say probably 50 times more than 4 years ago.
Right.
And that's increasing rapidly. So I don't think we need to play that role. I also don't think our average campaign costs, you know, maybe $150,000 all told for a couple of years, a master's degree, all of Rare's time and energy, and we can produce a tangible outcome. That wouldn't get you an ad in the New York Times
on Sunday
in the United States.
Whereas it gets you mariachis and all sorts of things.
Right. You get a full festival of environmental celebration for 12 intensive months.
Brett Jenks is the CEO of Rare. They can be found on the web at rareconservation.org. Unfortunately, it's time to go. There's so much more to talk about, but I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.